I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
On the next episode of The Trade Guys, we will talk all things WTO, the guys' favorite subject. All on the next episode of The Trade Guys. So, Trade Guys, we've got a lot to talk about when it comes to your favorite subject, the WTO. Tell me what is going on with the MC-13 failures.
It's a mixed bag. I think it was, from my point of view, largely a failure, but I think people went into it with lowered expectations. The business community's main expectation was let's not go backwards. Let's not make things worse. And at the last minute, they managed to not go backwards. The biggest accomplishment was simply to extend something that was in danger of expiring, and that was the so-called e-commerce moratorium, which is an agreed-upon prohibition on imposing taxes on e-commerce transactions. The West, for the most part, actually a lot of developed countries felt very strongly that not taxing e-commerce is an important element in economic growth. It's particularly encouraging to small and medium-sized enterprises in developing countries who are not in a position to pay taxes on it. And it's been contributing to digitization of the global economy and expansion of world trade. A couple countries, namely three, primarily India, but also South Africa and Indonesia, have regularly objected to extending the moratorium. What's happened with it is it's never been made permanent. So it expires each ministerial meeting. And so at the 12th ministerial meeting 2 years ago, they extended it to this one. So it was on the table again. It went down to the wire. Apparently at the very end, literally at the very end, the Indian ambassador, who had been the problem the whole time, announced that he was doing a personal favor to the chair of the conference, who was the United Arab Emirates trade minister, because the event was in Abu Dhabi, so the UAE was the host. And there was a plea from the minister not to screw everything up. And the Indian trade minister said as a favor to him, he was not going to object. So it was gaveled through for two more years, but there was a concession. You know, every other time it's been gaveled through with a statement that says the moratorium will continue until the next ministerial, unless ministers decide to extend it further. And this time, there were two changes. They dropped the until ministers decide to extend it further clause. I mean, ministers can, but it makes the battle next time slightly more uphill. And they also said by the next ministerial conference or March 31st, 2026, whichever comes first. Depending on when the ministerial is set, and I don't think they did that at last week, or depending on when it's set, in theory, the moratorium could expire before the ministerial occurs, which would be a disaster. Anyway, disaster was averted, so there's not a lot of talk here about blame, aside from India. They did one other positive thing. I mean, they did some small things. They let in two small countries, the Comoros and Timor-Leste, as new members. So the membership is now up to 166. They also agreed to put into the WTO rule book the joint statement initiative on services and regulation, domestic regulation of services. This is sort of important because this was not an agreement negotiated by everybody. Joint statement agreement is WTO language for plurilateral agreement, something that is reached by some of the members and not all of them. In this case, it was a whole bunch of them. And India and South Africa have regularly objected to plurilateral agreements. this is one of the issues that is going to have to be dealt with going forward. They object to them largely on the tactical grounds that if you start allowing plurilateral agreements, what that means is you're going to be creating rules that India can't object to because they don't take part in the plurilateral agreements, but they get a voice on whether the end result gets included in the WTO or not. And I think the Indian position is if we're not part of it, we didn't approve it. And in that case, we're going to block it. In this individual case, they chose not to block it. There were some wording concessions about how it wouldn't be a precedent. And in this particular case, the reality is it would be hard to block because the way it is implemented is simply that each country that signed up to it is going to adjust its schedule of services that are covered in the WTO anyway. That's a unilateral action that each country takes on its own that doesn't need the approval of anybody else. They're just listing, you know, their coverage. So that was a success, but the big stuff went down the drains. In the case of fish, literally, there was objection to further agreement on fisheries, mostly dealing with subsidies that contribute to illegal, unregulated, or unreported.
Wait, Bill, didn't the fisheries thing once look promising, though?
Well, part one was agreed to 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And part one covered direct subsidies for fishing. This one was intended, what they didn't do 2 years ago and what we're supposed to do this time was cover subsidies that contribute to overfishing. Things like, one of the biggest ones is subsidies on fuel for shipping boats, which just encourages the development of overcapacity in the fishing boat industry. It encourages the development of these enormous, large fishing boats, largely Chinese, that just scoop up, you know, they have enormous nets and they just scoop up everything in wherever they are and catch massive quantities of fish. That broke down on, again, via India, but I think also China, over disagreement over how to treat developing countries who always demand more time to comply with the rules and looser rules. India, I think, wanted 25 years to comply, which was really outrageous from everybody else's point of view. But it went down. The agriculture negotiation went down. That's been going on for 30 years. So people were disappointed. There was one big advance this year. They actually produced a text that people were prepared to negotiate on. I mean, for the previous 29 years, they couldn't even do that. So now there is a single text, but it's full of points of disagreement, which are bracketed in the way they do it. And here you had a couple problems. Once again, India was a big problem. India wants a permanent solution to what's called the public stockholding issue. Public stockholding is a provision, a temporary provision, that allows countries to subsidize their agricultural production in excess of the limits they've agreed to if it is for public stockholding. In other words, holding public stocks of food in order to avoid a famine or in order to avoid a food crisis. India wants a permanent permission to do that. This is another waiver that keeps expiring. And the problem is that most other countries, and this actually, there was a blow up about this that I'll talk about. Most other countries don't believe that India uses this provision to build its stocks. They believe it uses the provision to subsidize exports, which is not what they're supposed to be doing. And there was apparently a rather emotional outburst by the Thai ambassador to the WTO at the end, calling India to account for basically decimating the Thai rice industry and hurting Thai rice farmers through Indian subsidized exports, which they're not supposed to be doing. And it turned into a big deal. The Thais recalled their ambassador. The Indians filed a formal protest. There is much moaning and whining about this and a lot of people pulling their hair out. It was an emotional thing, but that tanked it. The other thing that tanked it is that there are a lot of agriculture issues. The one I just mentioned is only one. Another one is just getting lowering the subsidies, period, trying to get more in the direction of market principles. And another one is market access. A lot of countries have barriers of various kinds, sanitary and phytosanitary barriers, they call that, don't let other people's things in on various health-related grounds. And trying to get better rules there is another big issue. And a lot of countries said, we don't want to do one thing. You know, India wants to do one thing. They want to do public stockholding. We don't want to do that unless we can do all this other stuff too. So that was another sore point, partly because the EU did not want to do all that other stuff. So I blame the Indians. They were the proximate cause, but there were plenty other guilty parties.
I was going to say, it's not very nice to just blame the Indians now, is it?
Well, it's fun, though, Andrew.
Well, yeah, Bill enjoys it. But then again, look, Bill has given the sunny side of life view of the WTO.
That was the sunny side view?
That was the sunny side. Bill's saying, well, it really wasn't so bad. They got a couple things done. It was a low bar, but they managed to clear it. We managed not to go backwards. To my mind, this was an obvious leadership vacuum in this organization.
Sure seems that way.
That is playing out in every single issue. There is no individual, no country who is leading at the WTO. And that is potentially disabling for the organization. Look, let's start with fish. The direct subsidies, fishery subsidies, were supposed to have been agreed to 2 years ago and supposed to have entered into force by now, which they have not. They've only managed, they needed 110 economies to enter into force. They've got 71. They didn't even make that deadline. And Bill's right that the overfishing subsidies, the indirect subsidies, got nowhere. So that was a bust. They got nowhere in agriculture. There's a lot of getting nowhere in agriculture for 30 years. I'll get back to that. And then everything else was just trying to stay even. For me, the most amusing part is they talked about dispute settlement, and it's classic ministerial ease. It's like the coach who doesn't know what exactly to tell his team, what adjustments to have his team do at halftime. So he just says, get out there and fight, win. You know, it's a lot of bravado and encouragement with no action. So that's characteristic of this. But it looks to me like they were never prepared to engage in agriculture, which is actually quite complicated. Look, there's a reason this thing's gone nowhere for 30 years. And the biggest reason is what the problem is keeps changing. So if you think of the WTO as a table, a negotiating table, you have to figure out who's at the table and what is on offer. What are people actually talking about? My conclusion on agriculture is no one's at the table and no one's really seriously approaching this. So India gets the blame, but you know, look, agriculture is historically politically difficult. It's tough, and every minister wants to get into a negotiation, and when he or she gets home, they've got to tell their leaders, hey, we had a negotiation and we won, okay? Well, that takes some work, okay? And trade ministers haven't done the work. There's a lot of bargaining that hasn't happened. Now, at the end of the Uruguay round, it was really about the U.S. versus EU market access and subsidies, and to a lesser extent, food safety issues. You know, by 10 years later, by 2004, we were 3 years into the Doha Declaration, and it was developed versus developing. It was a north-south issue, and in this case, the developing countries wanted elimination of agriculture subsidies in the rich world, and the rich world wanted market access in ag and industrial goods. So they made it a bigger negotiation, which also failed. You know, by 2014, I think the American farmers had basically given up on agriculture negotiations. They were going nowhere. In the meantime, East Asia was getting rich and improving their diets, so they had plenty of markets for their soybeans and corn and production crops. Well, here it is, 2024, 30 years after we kicked this thing off. East Asia is not growing so fast anymore. Costs are high. And there's a lot of trade barriers still in place, and demand's not growing the way it was. So there's a lot of grumpiness in agriculture, but nobody is putting together a negotiation around that table that makes sense for all parties, where there's enough to bargain with to advance it. So we're just kidding ourselves on agriculture. And Bill's happy to blame the Indians, as am I. They're much deserving of blame. But somebody's got to do something. Look, you know, so we ended the ministerial down on plurilaterals. To my mind, the most economically beneficial policy of the WTO or agreement of the WTO is a plurilateral one. The information technology agreement, ITA 1 and ITA 2. That created more jobs, created greater expansion of an industry, created global wealth to a greater extent than any other WTO agreement since 1994. And it was plurilateral. You didn't have to join. So I say bring more.
The problem with that is, it's not a problem exactly, but the ITA agreements are what's called open agreements. That means that not everybody participated in it, so not everybody had to agree, but the benefits apply to everybody. You know, the countries agreed to zero out their tariffs on information technology products, and the negotiation was really about what was going to be on the list and what was not. And because it's a rapidly moving sector, they've done it. They had ITA 1, they have ITA 2, and now there's talk about ITA 3 because there's all these new products, you know. But it means the people that didn't play can be free riders. You know, they can benefit. The reason they did it anyway, I mean, there's people don't like free riders, but the reason they did it anyway is because when they did the first ITA agreement, I think the countries that joined it accounted for 94% of the global production of the products that were covered. So there weren't going to be any significant free riders. You know, the people that actually were involved in that kind of trade were all in the game and were all going to play. The more of these you do, I think it becomes maybe a little bit more problematic. There's been a lot of talk over the years about if we did that for information technology, maybe we can do it for other sectors. Maybe we can do it for chemicals. Maybe we can do it for plastics or services where they're actually trying to do it. And one of the problems is that when you get outside of a very small number of sectors, it's hard to have a plurilateral agreement that includes most of the production. So there would be a lot of free riders, I think, if you did a chemicals agreement. And then that's going to concern people because basically what that says is we're going to lower our chemical tariffs to zero, but you don't have to. But you can benefit from what we've done, but you don't have to do anything in return. There's kind of a visceral, you know, this is not reciprocal. Why are we letting them get away with it? It actually is trade expanding, but...
Right. And talk to the industry. They'll tell you a zero tariff is a better way to operate.
It's where we're going with this. This is the wave of the future, though. I think Scott and I have talked about this in the past. More and more people are saying, and a lot of them said after last week, I know Tiffany Smith, who's the vice president of my former organization, the National Foreign Trade Council, said we need to focus on plurilaterals because it's obvious, based on last week, that we're not going to be able to get everybody to agree to anything important. And so let's do coalitions of the willing. Let's get all the countries together that want to do something ambitious, and let's just do that. That, of course, the Indians object to, because then basically
they're
said,
left out.
Well, we had a few years ago, we had a meeting here with a senior WTO official who was clear that, you know, the Indians in particular are very good at hostage taking. And I would say basically their proposal, their position has been consistently, we want what we want. And if we can't get what we want, we'll make sure nobody else gets anything. And what that has done is really crippled the organization. I mean, there's blame to go around, and you can always make the point, because this is common in the WTO, that countries hide behind the bad guy. So, you know, maybe there was only one that objected, but there may have been 10 or 15 more that wanted to object too, but they didn't have the same courage. So they just hid behind the one that was willing to object. But it's beginning to look more and more like it's going to be very difficult to produce any more truly multilateral agreements that cover all 166 members.
That makes me sad.
Well, it should, because it's not trade expanding. Although I have to say, I went to an interesting dinner the other night with some Europeans, and we sort of talked about this, and it was someone from the U.S. government there that was sort of talking about U.S. trade policy.
This is one of those insider Washington things where you can't name who you were with.
I'm not allowed to name, but they really were not Washington insiders. They were out-of-towners who came to town for a variety of purposes. They were mostly from the country that put on the event. But it got into a question of U.S. trade policy and EU trade policy because we were talking about the Green Aluminum Steel Sustainability Agreement, the GASA, and you know, what sort of came out of the conversation was the U.S. is not really any longer pursuing a trade expansion policy. We're pursuing a trade distribution policy where we're trying to get the benefits to accrue to the workers and not corporate CEOs. The EU believes that it's pursuing a trade expansion policy, which means lower tariffs, more market access, the things that we used to do. I think there's some truth to that distinction. We are not any longer very interested in expanding trade and are beginning to be quite blunt about that. I mean, they'd be quite blunt in saying, basically, don't expect the United States to open its markets further in this administration. And, of course, where that takes you is if we're not going to give anybody anything, they're not going to give us anything. And that makes the negotiations much more complicated than they used to be.
I would agree with at least that characterization of the U.S., which I think is we have stepped away from leadership of a market opening, expansive trade policy for a lot of reasons. And we did it on a bipartisan basis. Don't get me wrong, but that's where we are. I have real doubts that the Europeans can fill that vacuum. Mostly because while they're philosophically, they may be in support of an open trade agenda. When it comes right down to it, Europe's first concern is always settling internal differences. This is why Europe could never lead on agriculture, is they couldn't really give anything to the French plum farmers if they didn't give something to the insert name of country, insert specialty crop. They were always trading off issues, which is the essence of European politics. You know, it's a crowded continent. It's about the same landmass as North America. And there are three nation states in North America, something like 51 or 52 nation states in Europe. And so this balancing act is essential for them. It's what they know. But as a result, they have a tough time being an unambiguous leader of any particular agenda. So I don't know who steps in for the U.S. We're obviously not willing to be captain of the football team anymore.
Well, how's the rest of the world feel about this dilemma and situation?
Well, that's why, in a way, why we have a problem. I think it goes back to 2008 when the Doha round, the last failed round, failed. And I think what's happened there and what's persisted ever since is that the countries that designed and created the system, us, the Europeans, this is before the EU, the individual European countries and a few others, we've kind of run out of gas. I mean, the public is less willing to sustain the costs of trade liberalization. There's more complaints about imports, and there's a growing concern on the part of European and American governments that there's countries that have benefited enormously from the system. China, the big emerging economies, China, Brazil, actually South Africa and India, too, have benefited enormously from the system, and they should step up and assume more obligations. In other words, they should pay more, because we've been paying for 75 years. And the response of those countries has been, no, we don't want to do that. First of all, we didn't design the system, you designed the system. We don't have the same investment in it that you do. And second, we want to keep getting in the benefits without having to pay for them. And so there's kind of an impasse. You know, the political will in the United States and I think in the EU to really lead in this area. And leading in trade means basically more often than not taking one for the team, you know, and making concessions to keep the system going. And the political will to do that is fading here. And nobody else has stepped up. I mean, if you look at the Chinese, which are a logical candidate to step up, I've had to negotiate with them. I've never met anybody who has a better, clearer sense of what's good for them and who are exclusively focused only on what's good for them. They can accept win-win outcomes. I mean, in contrast to Donald Trump, for example, would tends to view these things as sort of zero sum. I don't win unless you lose. The Chinese are capable of saying, you know, it's okay if you win, but as long as I win, then it's all right. But that's not leadership. That's not stepping up and saying, we're prepared to make some sacrifices in the interest of keeping the system going and keeping the rules going. And that's why I think we're in a difficult situation right now, because nobody's willing to do that. The U.S. role last week was complicated. I think that they kind of got religion on the e-commerce moratorium at the very end. There was doubt in the business community as to whether we really were committed to extending it. In the end, we were and did, but people were not sure about that. We have been the country really holding up progress on dispute settlement. There's a bunch of low-hanging fruit there, small rules changes, simply process changes that would make the system work faster and better. And we've not been excited about just going ahead with those. We want to do everything at once. And that means we're at the mercy of solving more contentious issues like what to do about the appellate process, the second level of the dispute settlement resolution, which is why nothing happened. And as Scott said, you know, on that, we kicked the can till the end of 2024, which is what the U.S. wanted. This is not really a profile of strong leadership, and it's not a profile of a country that's willing to give very much right now. And I think the USTR reaction to that would be, well, we don't really have the political support to give much right now. And they're probably right about that, which is sad.
Well, I think we've gotten to the bottom of the WTO today. Guys, thanks so much.
Sorry for the bleak outlook, Andrew.
I know, my God.
We got to tell our listeners what we think.
Everybody's sad. Everybody's bummed. But have a good weekend, right?
Well, you know, there is a bit of good news that Bill mentioned how contentious the dispute settlement process has been, particularly the role of the appellate body. And while the WTO has a relatively small staff, it has roughly 650 or so people in Geneva, most of whom are translators. So it doesn't have a big staff like UN-style staff, but occasionally staffers make a big impact. And there was a long-serving director of the secretariat that managed the appellate body named Werner Zadok. He's an Austrian, been in the job since 2006. And he retired, which I view as a breakthrough opportunity to do something positive, because most of the difficulties arose during his period in that role, and he was a number of the decisions that he advanced as a key staffer were strongly opposed by the United States. In fact, believed to be inconsistent with our obligations. So maybe there's a window of opportunity with new staff. Although, as I said, it's not an organization that relies on staff. It's a member-driven organization.
Well, farewell to both of you, gentlemen, and we will see you next week.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.